All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
It's a Steve show. This is a Steve show,
bro.
I believe our best episodes are when we don't know the guys. And...
yeah, everybody, calm down, because I can't carry.
Okay, I'm just letting y'all know. I know five to one.
All right, you know 5-1.
When I start talking Takeover, you jump in, Fonte.
I know that whole Val Kilmer movie. Yeah. I know the whole Val Kilmer movie. I mean, I saw it.
I know. Light My Fire, of course.
Right. Yes. Aren't there samples? Did anyone sample the Doors?
Yes, we're cool.
Okay, y'all.
Amir's a drummer too, by the way.
I know, right? I think we have a whole thing about drummers. What kind of sticks you like?
We're gonna take the Donnie Simpson test today.
Yeah. Okay. I ain't mad at that. Okay. All right, y'all ready?
I'm with it.
All right, here we go.
Oh,
there's djembe happening already.
let's go.
How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm good.
Good to be here with you.
Oh, hey. I don't know if you can see this. My wardrobe.
I can see. Late night with Jimmy Fallon. I see
it.
Oh, look at that.
Thank you.
He sat in with us.
Yes, I remember.
Late night. Yeah, man. Is it because of COVID that the roots are pared down?
Yeah, it's because of COVID. Yeah. We can't. Yeah. State law says that only six people out of 11 are in formation. So that's how it is.
Okay. Well, I used to love that. The tuba duplicating the bass lines. It sent me right to New Orleans. It's beautiful.
Nice.
Octave lower.
Yeah.
That's cool. Crap, since we already talking, let me start the introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove Supreme. My name is Questlove. We have Team Supreme with us. We got Fontigalo. Hello, sir.
What up? Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. This is also the time that I'm not pluralizing the word year. I always say Happy New Year's, and I've been corrected one too many times. Sugar Steve, hello.
Hello. How you doing, everybody? Hi, John.
It's kind of weird for me to say hello to you because I see you every day. So
yeah, I'm pretty sick of you too. Let's move on.
Okay. Yeah.
He's really excited. This is so cool.
Unpaid bill.
Happy
this
runoff.
This is going to be the Sugar Steve Really Is Alive episode.
Yeah.
Unpaid bill is with us as well. How you doing?
Good.
Unpaid
happy bill. Runoff day. Good to talk now.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy whatever you said day.
Yep.
And Laya is with us as well.
That's right. Happy 50th month, my friend.
Yes, oh, you're right with me. There's okay. You're still 19.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Yes, I'm right with you as far as our birthdays on the same day. But it's your 50.
But not
that's
50.
Different. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So our guest today, y'all. our guest today.
This is huge, man.
Yeah, very huge. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's literally from one of the most influential bands of all time. The Doors have sold over 100 million records. That's nothing to scoff at. Their music and their influence still resonate to this day. Yes, I don't know if you know that, John, but you've sold over 100 million records.
Those are actual records, too, not streams.
That's true.
I better check records. check my royalties.
Yeah, yeah. We're on the verge of an ASCAP payback today. It'd be good for John.
not to mention our guest is also an author, actor, playwright, Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award winner and recipient, and we are extremely honored to have him talk shop with us today in his illustrious career. Please welcome to Questlove Supreme, John Densmore, drummer of The Doors.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Hey, yo. Thank you. And I'm not dead, you know?
Yes, you're very much alive. Yes,
a good start. Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's an achievement. Yeah. We're all alive right now. Where are you right now?
I'm in my office / rehearsal room, you know?
Okay. I mean, like, in what part of the world are you?
Oh, I'm in L.A.,
okay.
Where I was born. My mom was born here in 1904. And okay. But we're not native. The Chumash Indians are the first peoples. Got to get that right.
You better credit. You better get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So listen, I want to say I'm really pleased to be doing this because, you know, Quest and I are in the same tribe. A tribe called drummers.
Yes, exactly. Yes, we are.
You know, and
nice,
I just
nice wordplay there.
I love that. You know, you're the leader of the Roots, and not a lot of drummers are leaders, and it makes me think of you and Lionel Hampton or Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. You know, who I saw many times, or Chico Hamilton, who I stole the ride cymbal bell beat from. You know, so.
Wait,
how did you pull that off?
Time out. Please tell our audience who Chico Hamilton is, please, because nobody ever talks about him.
Okay. Well, he was a wonderful jazz cat in the early 60s, and I saw him as a teenager. I think Charles Lloyd was playing with him. And man, you know, I heard a real cool thing, and I later put it in the end. You know, right. You steal from the best, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Flattery.
I was going to say though, you told me at Fallon that your weapon of choice wasn't initially the drums. You started out, you said, as a piano player.
Yeah, that's in my new book. My mom is the first chapter because she encouraged me to play piano, and I just was crazy for music, and I wanted to play any instrument. And then I got into junior high, and there was no piano in the band or the orchestra, and I chose clarinet because I thought, you know, Benny Goodman's cool, whatever. And I had braces on my teeth, and they said, no, you can't do that, you're trying to push them back, and they're going to come out with that instrument. So drums, yeah. So I owe my career to the dentist, you know.
Really? Oh, so you're saying that adults encouraged you to play the drums? Because normally in my situation, adults, drums are always the last resort of every drummer that
guitar.
I know, because their parents don't want them to make noise or anything.
I got you. No, my parents were okay with it. But Quest, did you have one of those black rubber pads, a drum pad? You know, they bounce back, but they have no sound. And that's what you got to do when you're too loud.
Right, exactly. Well, even that, I'll say, like, my first 2 years of taking drum lessons, you know, my teacher had like this shiny Ludwig drum set and also a practice pad next to that drum set.
Yeah.
And we would just walk to the practice pad, and I would ask him, like, wait, when do I get to play those?
Yeah.
And he's like, you're not ready yet. So, like, for 2 years, I had to play on that practice pad, almost like it was like torture for, you know, to sit there in front of that drum set and not even touch it for the first 2 years.
Yeah, but no, same deal with me. I was told if I took private lessons, I'd get better. And so I did. And I was surrounded by drum sets on the damn practice pad with the teacher.
So who was your North Star as far as drumming was concerned? Like, you know, because I mean, you were the rock era, the modern rock era. So it wasn't like you have tales of seeing anyone that modern musicians see now. So who was your North Star as far as like who would have been your Beatles on Sullivan moment as far as like, that's what I want to do for a living?
Elvin Jones.
Wow. Great.
I got my fake ID in Tijuana. and went to Shelley's manhole, which the doorman looked at and said, "This is fake, but come on in," you know. and I saw Coltrane many times. Oh, my, oh my God.
I wanted you to say that your fake ID said Elvin Jones on it.
What was that like to see people that we take for granted? I don't think we've ever had a guest on the show that
saw Coltrane.
That seemed like gods, and you knew they were gods then. So what was that like for you to see?
All right. Well, you can read all about it in my new book. The second or third chapter is on Elvin. So, you know, I knew there was magic. I mean, I didn't know that I was seeing iconic, that people were going to be just legendary, you know. But I sensed just, I don't know, there was fire and energy. Like, I couldn't believe the conversation Elvin would have with Coltrane. There'd just be, you know, he'd keep the groove, but he'd be riffing off him all the time. And, you know, it gave me a little courage now and then to riff off Jim Morrison, you know, and fuck around with what he's saying and, you know, keep the groove. But, you know, Elvin, he's my man. And so after Coltrane died, I saw Elvin. Well, let me back up. Mm-hmm. All right. So my idols are in the dressing room at the jazz club, and the bathroom is right next to the jazz club, next to the, my brain. It's where the musicians hang out, the green room. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the bathroom a lot, you know, because they were right around the corner, you know.
Right.
And I was afraid to say anything. But later, after Coltrane died, I introduced myself to Elvin. And I have three self-centered memoirs. And the first one, Riders on the Storm, I gave to Elvin, and I quickly said, "Hey, man, I wrote in here, you gave me my hands," you know, worried that he would be condescending, this jazz giant. And he was so warm and friendly, and I saw him many more times, and I took his cymbal bag to the car towards the end of his life. So we're talking a real mentor, you know.
What was it about his playing? Because a lot of homies I went to school with that were in the jazz department, they all like just swore by Elvin Jones. So if you could explain to kind of a layperson, what was it about his drumming technique that just made him so amazing?
I think they called it polyrhythms. You know, I mean, he'd have the pocket. You have to have the pocket, of course, but he was continually playing triplets and all this shit all going on all the time, like churning up a rhythmic egg beater. and it sounded like he was going to fall into his kit. But he didn't, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's how I describe it, you know.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So with your clear love for jazz, did you ever actually play jazz in a serious way?
Yeah. A few years back, I had a group called Tribal Jazz, which was a jazz quartet or quintet with two African drummers, which was really fun because, you know, I'm trying to integrate Senegalese rhythms into a drum kit, you know. So it rearranged some brain cells. It was good.
And what about back when you were younger? Did you play any jazz then?
Well, as a kid, like crazy. And then I stumbled into this rock band. Yeah.
I say it worked out pretty good.
Yeah. No one's ever heard of.
Well, let me ask, because, like, was there musical snobbery in the 60s to the level of where, you know, like it was a big deal for like Leonard Cohen to say, like, "I actually like the Beatles," like that sort of thing.
Oh, I see.
Was it a struggle back then to win respect? Like, did you care as much or just were you unaware?
Back then, the whole country was polarized into for and against the Vietnam War. Kind of like today's kind of polarized, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rock and roll was against the war and sort of a liberal bent. And so you were either for that. Or, you know, I would say that country music kind of represented the other side. But The last chapter I got in this book is on Willie Nelson. And, you know, I'm looking for the soul in any genre. You know, I can get fed by if you're saying something truthful, and if it's in a simplistic form, it doesn't matter, man. In fact, in my old age, I've learned that if I put the right cymbal crash in the exact right spot, it can be as powerful as, you know, in my 20s when I showed all my shit or when I had more chops. You know what I mean?
What was the modern music scene like in Los Angeles in the mid 60s before you guys really got established? Like, was Whiskey a Go-Go a thing sort of before you guys came along, or like what was the modern scene like?
Exactly. Now, the Whiskey was Mecca. And we were playing in a little club a block down from the Whiskey. The night we were fired because there was a fight, which we did not cause, but they blamed it on the band. The booker from the Whiskey dropped in and saw us. And she hired us as the house band at the Whiskey. And it was heaven. I mean, every night the streets were packed with hippies and music freaks and every band that came in, I don't know, let's see, Frank Zappa, Captain Beefheart, Van Morrison, et cetera, et cetera, the Birds, all of, you know, they had to deal with the opening act.
Wow.
I don't mean to, well, that sounds a little self-serving, but we were different. We were the undeclared Vietnam War. We were not singing about peace and love. We were singing about, this is the end, beautiful friend, man. There's a lot of lying going on. And so, you know, we'd play Light My Fire and everybody dance, and that was really cool. And then we'd play The End, and it got very quiet. and then people had to follow that, the other bands, which, I mean, we were friends with them all, but it was a really cool scene.
Well, what were your thoughts on like the post-mod kind of movement of music? Like people that weren't that political and more poppy, like, I still want to know, like, were there different tribes or different cliques of, you guys mesh together at all?
You know, the British Invasion was kind of poppy, you know, but then we all started experimenting with then legal psychedelics and the Beatles music got a little darker like ours. Yeah. So
did you appreciate it at the time? Well, appreciate their contribution at the time. You know, it's from a person from my generation, we'll be quick to lump like anyone that came from the mid to late 60s in the same bowl. You know, I'm certain that 3-4 decades from now, you know, somebody will look at my band or Fonte's band and, you know, just think like, oh, okay, well, you know, Kanye West, Outkast, you guys are all the same. We've talked much shit about each other and that sort of thing. So like, you know, what were your thoughts on your contemporaries at the time?
Yeah.
Like the Stones, the Beatles, the Who, the Kinks.
Let me break it down. You know, in the beginning, I was a jazz snob, but I was certainly aware of the roots of rock and roll, Chuck Berry and Little Richard and all, and Elvis and whatever. Then I saw these four mop tops on Ed Sullivan, and I thought, wow, man, what are they gay? What is this? You know? Then I noticed
a random thing.
I noticed their melodies. I thought, wow, you know, because melodies, man, are the key. I don't care if it's heavy metal or country. If you got a beautiful melody with a cool lyric, they got to be wedded together. Wow, you got great songs. So I knew the Beatles had great songs, and we looked up to the Stones and like that.
Were they of an older generation to you? Because even in my world, like someone that came out 4 or 5 years ago, I'll see that as, in hip hop terms, like someone that made their debut in 2010 even is kind of old. Even though they're not old school, they're considered old school. So, you know, because of the years between you guys, them starting in 61, 62, was it still the same fraternity, or were they seen as older statesmen? Not older statesmen, but that's what I'm asking.
No, they were just a few years older, so they weren't an entirely different genre, you know. And then as you go along, can you keep making records that are important? And a lot of folks fall by the wayside, and we managed to do okay. Even though Jim, you know, he started drinking so much that it got quite difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, like I got a chapter in this new book on Jim and one on Janis, Janis Joplin. Mm-hmm. Two cautionary tales, you know. Self-destruction and creativity come in the same package with them, but not with everybody.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte Sigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
We're really good friends with Shep Gordon.
Oh, yeah.
Who told us a lot about the scene in LA, especially at the hotel. I forget the hotel in Sunset where.
Yeah.
Oh, where they were fighting.
Everyone. Yeah. Well, yeah. Everyone just hung and whatnot. Like you spoke of the group Love and all those things. Were you directly like a part of that scene, like off stage, where you guys sort of.
Not quite that scene. I'm trying to think of the hotel too, but once you played the whiskey, Mario, the door guy, let anybody in. So we would all go see each other when we were not playing. And so it was a fraternity, you know, and we love, for example, man, they were really liked them a lot. They were so different. Forever Changes is a masterpiece, that album.
Yeah. Forever Changes is a masterpiece. It's, you know, that's from the Summer of Love too. I mean, there's a few albums from that era that are just, yeah.
I want to get on the soapbox for a second.
All right.
Get on it.
Let's go.
I get pissed off when people diss the 60s as a failure.
Hmm. Wait, who disses the 60s as a failure?
Oh, good. Okay. All right.
Isn't our life based on everything from the 60s?
I mean, well, there's no progress without the 60s.
All right, never mind what I was going to say.
Oh, no, I want to hear it. Okay, let's go.
Somebody out there is feeling that way, so go ahead and talk to
them. Yeah, well, there is the perception that, like, post-69, that there was not diminished returns, per se, but everything was over, and everything that was fought for and built was sort of just washed away. So,
well,
what were you saying?
Well, yeah, the seeds of civil rights, the peace movement, feminism, all were planted in the 60s.
Right.
And maybe these seeds take like a long time, 50, 100 years for full fruition.
Mm-hmm.
So don't diss, you know, we're on the shoulders of all the folks before. And so, you know, yeah, progress is not as fast as we wanted, you know, like, gee, Obama got elected, so there's no more racism. Yeah, right. you know. So, but anyway, and speaking of which, I was hoping sometime during this podcast I could do a 5-minute poem for Stacey Abrams.
Oh,
because I've been thinking about.
Jesus.
All right, now I'm going to prove.
Never had that before.
I'm going to prove I'm the drummer, not the singer. I've been thinking about Georgia, Georgia, no peace, I find you're on my mind. Well, they're voting today. You
Georgia's
know?
Definitely on our minds.
Yeah,
yeah.
Man,
so
it's on everybody's mind.
I want to do a little.
By the time this airs, we'll have the results that we want.
Yeah. There you go.
But we're going to get that poem too, because I want to hear that ode to Stacey. Yes.
I was curious to know, man, do you have to give us kind of a parallel, the band that The Doors and kind of what you guys represented when you guys came out, who would you say is probably the closest modern day contemporary? And by modern day, I mean, it could be anyone from the last, you know, 20 years, whatever, but that you think kind of embodies the spirit of what you guys were about?
Mm. Oh, putting me on the spot here.
I mean, Nirvana would be my guess.
Really?
Yeah.
You know what's weird though? I always thought the Doors were. Doors are really kind of. I feel like the Doors are hip hop as far as their rebellion is concerned.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Okay.
So.
Let me tell you something. Way back, Jay-Z asked for
5-1.
Five to one.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just coming on board. I didn't know what was happening, and I went, "Wait a minute. You know what? Huh?" It's all bitches and hoes. No, you can't have it. And he writes me a letter and he sends me a Team Rock jersey and he breaks it down for me. And he says, man, you know, we're doing what you're doing, fighting the establishment, going for truth. And I then I got it. Believe me, I got it.
Okay.
Along those lines, The Doors is one of the only bands that I can think of that didn't have a bass player. And while Ray played bass in his left hand, it was one of the few bands that didn't have like a legit bass player. Can you talk about what that was like? Because
that's
not a thing. It's not a normal thing.
A lot of work. I mean, usually the bass player and the drummer are the rhythm section, you know, holding down the groove in the basement. And it was me and Ray's left hand. And
wow.
But he played simplified sort of boogie-woogie bass lines with his left hand, which turned out to be gold, like don't, 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 don't. It's just hooky stuff. And so fortunately, we felt the same pocket. Actually, the first tune we played together ever was All Blues by Miles Davis.
By Miles Davis, yeah.
Which is in three, you know. And then I knew Ray knew some shit. So then we played the blues, and we were sort of laying back on the groove, as you do with the blues. And then we started writing our own stuff, and then we kind of found our pocket. But
so were you and Ray the kind of the start of the Doors? Were you the primary songwriters, or how did that work?
Well, Jim had all these words and melodies and couldn't play one chord on any instrument.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking gifted here. Mm-hmm. So he would sing a cappella and, you know, Roadhouse Blues, which we played with you guys, you know, is a blues. That's not too difficult, but he would sing these complicated "Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss." Like, wait a minute, F sharp, what the hell? You know, he just had this shit in his head. So, wow, you know.
So what were those songwriting sessions like? Like, he would just, would it start with him and his words first, and you guys figure out where he's going with it?
Yeah. We'd figure out the groove, then we'd stop and change chords or say, oh man, we need a bridge or a solo here or whatever. So that's why he said, hey, let's credit all the songs written by the Doors, not lyrics by me, you know.
Wow.
And let's split all the dough. Really?
Wow.
Whoa.
Can I ask a question? Because you talked about this and you touched on it, but I got to know, you said that you were kind of like in your own snobby sense when you were an early musician, and somehow you met him and he convinced you to go to this route, because it sounds like you weren't even trying to go this rock and roll route. Like, you had this jazz mind. So what was that moment that he convinced you?
You know, I was passionate for music, but I never thought I'd make a living at it. Mm. You know what I mean?
What did you think?
Join the club.
You know how it, and then when the Doors got going, I thought, oh God, man, you know, if we can pay the rent for a decade, wouldn't that be a miracle? Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I'm 76, and it's 50 years later. I'm still talking about this damn band, but you know.
So was it a conversation that you had that convinced you that I'm gonna ride this ride because I know that this is going somewhere, or was it something that he's saying or something?
Yeah. Good. All right. So after we play All Blues, and I'm noticing this guy in the corner, and Ray says, "Jim, this is Jim, the singer. He's never sung before, and he can't play any instrument, but look at these lyrics." And he hands me a crumpled piece of paper. And on the paper, it says, "Day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Tried to run, tried to hide, break on through to the other side." Whoa. Okay. Oh, right away.
Right.
Rhythmic stuff starts. That pulled me in immediately, you know? So
I always wanted to know, was that song somewhat influenced from Ray Charles's "What I Say"?
Oh wow! It's funny, man.
We're past the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, this is good. No, you know, I used to play that. "What Did I Say"? Only I couldn't do it with one hand. I had to have both hands on the bell of the ride cymbal.
Right.
Didn't have the chops yet. Anyway, what was going on was, Bossa Nova was coming up from Brazil, big time. And so this little
girl from Ipanema.
Yeah. And I'm digging the groove. It's real light. Okay, I'm going to make it stiffer and harder and faster. And so I copped the whole thing and made it rock and roll. But Break On Through is kind of a rock and bossa nova rock or whatever.
Bossa rock.
Can I ask a question? Getting back to what Bill asked you about playing with Ray Manzarek and him playing the bass with his left hand. So that's the Doors sound basically. But on later albums, you did use actual electric bass players on certain things.
Really, really good question.
Oh, on the Posthumous Records, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My question is actually, what as the drummer, from the drummer's perspective, what's the difference being, part half the rhythm section with somebody who's playing it on the organ and somebody who's playing it with a guitar?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when we played live, when Ray would take a solo on organ, he'd get excited. And the bass player would speed up. Holy moly.
There's nothing more frustrating than that happening.
I got to pull the reins back. Okay, so this was before Moog synthesizers were even invented. So we knew that the keyboard bass he had, a Fender Rhodes keyboard bass, kind of was mushy. Yeah. And it needed a little more punch. And so even on the first record, we had Larry Nechtel, studio bass player, overdub on Fender electric bass, Ray's exact bass lines to give it the pluck of the string, gave it the punch we needed, you know. And then later we did have bass players, and, Harvey Brooks was on Soft Parade, great bass player, played with Dylan and the Electric Flag. And so that was a lot of fun for me, you know. Elvis's bass player played on L.A. Woman, Jerry Sheff, and that was cool. He even said that he put a little line from L.A. Woman. He stuck a little bit of it in an Elvis recording session, so that was cool.
Oh, really?
So we can just finish up this thought: that playing with Ray versus playing with Harvey Brooks. From a rhythm section.
Yeah.
Sense.
Yeah. Well, I could almost play one handed, because when there's a separate bass player plucking and concentrating on the groove, he's your brother helping. It's easier,
Okay.
And you play off each other and whatever. And Ray was playing sort of simplistic lines, but it kind of gave space. There was more air and openness in the sound, which was quite cool and unique. We auditioned bass players way back. We even had a girl for a minute there, but we felt like we sound like another white blues band, the Rolling Stones or something. And then we discovered this keyboard bass and went, oh man.
Yeah.
And the guy who made all the LSD in San Francisco, I can't think of his name.
You can't think of his name. Of course you can't.
Well, I can't. What was
all
your
of
name?
Give me all of it.
We were playing one of the psychedelic ballrooms. He comes back. Owsley. That's his name. Owsley. He comes backstage and says, hey, man, you guys, you're great. You got a hole in your sound, though. You need a bass player. He leaves. And I turned to Ray and I said, wow, we're making the Acid King nervous. I think we're on the right track here.
I have a question. I can't think of another, besides the Look of Love, I believe that Light My Fire.
The most covered song ever.
Probably, no. Even more than that. I feel like Light My Fire is probably the only song in which you cannot drop the ball as far as covering is concerned. And billions of people have covered it. Do you have a preference of the many covers that of that song?
First of all, Quest, thanks for putting Light My Fire in the same category as The Look of Love. Who
I'm
sang
just saying,
that?
I've never found a bad cover of Light
classic,
My Fire.
Man.
Who sang
that? Classic,
never found a bad cover of Light My Fire, never found a bad cover of Look of Love. Like, it's impossible to drop the ball on that song.
Who sang Look of Love?
The original was, who was the original?
Oh, well.
So was many.
It Dionne Warwick?
Yeah, probably.
Right. Okay, so what's cool is somebody covers your song and finds a new way to interpret it. That's really cool. I mean, it's cool to get any song covered, even if they copy your arrangement, because you get the writer's share. But
facts.
But
yep.
Jose Feliciano takes Light My Fire, and he makes it a ballad. Yeah. And we all went, wow, that is beautiful.
What did you think of Al Green's version, man? I think that's probably my favorite one.
I didn't hear it. Give it to me. Really? He did it?
What? You never heard Al Green's version of Light My Fire?
Jesus Christ.
Can we play it
for you? Oh, my God.
Wait a minute.
This is fair use. This is fair use podcast.
Yeah.
Fair use. We talk about it. Journalistic.
Even the spoken part is the
come on,
right,
man.
Right. There's his version, and John, have you ever heard the Free Design? Have you ever heard their version of it?
Jesus Christ.
Oh.
Yeah, Free Design.
Ooh, they bodied that
they
the mamas and the papas on LSD.
Yeah, they take chromatic ninth harmony chords to another place. I'll say the Free Design is probably my go-to version, even though I love Al's version. Actually, it's funny you mentioned Jose. Jose actually doubles down because even on Minnie Riperton's version, Jose shows up and does his riffing at the end.
Yeah. Light my fire.
Right, exactly.
Oh, Minnie Riperton, wow.
So, okay. I gotta know this because the one thing that I know that you're big on, which you know, it's weird because even though with the rebellion of the first wave of modern rock, not modern rock, but you know the 60s rock cats and hip hop cats, is this rebellious spirit to the system, but somehow. I will say that in hip hop terms, our relationship with capitalism slightly differs from the 60s rock generation.
How so?
You know, licensing songs and commercial uses, you know, rappers are about that all day. I made a commercial. Whereas, you know, I often hear the 60s generation sort of like, I'm not selling out and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So you're world famous for your thumbs down on licensing.
Turned out a lot of paper, man.
Which, you know, I'm like, that must be nice. But
I see it from all sides. I mean, you know, Tavis Smiley said to me, you're either really great or you're crazy, you know, about that. But what can I say? If you're trying to pay the rent and you do it, man. It's hard enough out there. What happened was that we got this offer. Come on, Buick, light my fire.
That ain't it.
Yeah. And
see, that's not in the article. That's not on the Google. Like, if the Google said that, it'd be a very different thing. That's
everyone would understand why you told them to fuck off.
So, Jim was out of town. It was a lot of dough, and we were kind of drooling. And he came back, and he said, "Yeah, let's do it." And I got a really good idea for a TV ad. I'll smash a Buick on television with a sledgehammer.
That's a great idea.
Okay.
And that's light it on fire.
That's a no. And so, all right. Jim wrote one line in Light My Fire. Robbie Krieger wrote all the lyrics, and Jim added, our love become a funeral pyre. Morrison-esque. And so this guy is so upset about a song he didn't write. I'm like, wow. He cares about the whole catalog, everything we're doing. And, you know, I'm a little hard ass, but he's passed. He's my ancestor. So I'm trying to stick to what he wanted. But I mean, you know, I get, hey, you know, I get hip hoppers doing. I get it. You know, mm-hmm. It's just we're different. And it was back a ways. And I don't know. Set
in a modern context. If they might offer you a lot more money now for something than you were offered for the Buick ad, And it, yeah, kind of, it would be kind of a no-brainer to take the money. I mean,
just, and also too, to be fair, I think now it may be, I think now you have people in position who understand kind of the spirit of what you guys were about and would do it in a very tasteful way as opposed to a cheesy way, like, you know, like my Buick, whatever the hell, you know, I think people now, you know what I'm saying?
Actually, I would like to see someone set a Buick on fire.
All right, let's see. Break on through to a new deodorant. No.
Yeah. No, no.
Right.
Like but I think.
Break on.
But the thing is, that I think the common denominator for the average creator is avoiding erasure. And
yeah,
yes, the music of the Doors, I feel, is, you know, at least the ripple effect and the resonance of it all. I have no doubt that the songs, you know, I Riders of the Storm still sound, every time I play it, people, you know, oh my God, what is that? Like it's brand new or something.
Yeah, thanks.
So, you know, it's timeless. But does it ever, do you ever have thoughts that, you know, one day, because, you know, I will say that when songs are placed in, and this is me as a DJ speaking, when songs are placed in a movie or placed on a television show or in a commercial, it just extends the life of it just a little bit more. Yeah. So I'm one of those guys. And again, as a DJ who mainly uses his DJ sets to educate people on stuff, it kind of makes my job easier. Even though I have to correct them, like, no, this isn't just the song that you heard in the blah, blah, blah movie. Like, right, this is where it comes from. But do you ever have thoughts of, like, if you clutch too tight to the pearls, that there's a possibility of erasure? I know the Beastie Boys are going through that right now. Like, they just recently kind of loosened the reins a little bit to allow one of their songs to get licensed for a commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though they took this hard stance, like, we will never, ever do that.
Right.
Like, integrity.
And, yeah, I gotcha. I mean, you know, Bob Dylan's certainly making me nervous.
Man.
Yeah.
He sold all his shit.
I was about to say, he's been doing it for a while, right? Like,
yeah, but yeah, he can't take it with him, so you might as well just, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
okay, so first of all, I don't, we okay movies, TV shows. It's just a specific product selling, which makes me twitch a little. Okay. I mean, like, and also we are pretty established, and there's a lot of people who say to us, oh man, you know, I was in Vietnam. You guys helped me. First time I made love, the first time I had a joint, whatever. And so it's sort of like the soundtrack to people's lives. And so I kind of, well, Vietnam, for example, recently Robbie told me, I didn't know this, that the lyric Love Me Two Times, he wrote, it goes, Love Me Two Times because I'm going away. He was thinking going away to Vietnam, but that's not in the lyric. And so how about Love Me Two Times because I just took Viagra?
Yeah, it's true. Some commercials have seriously ruined certain songs forever, you know, where they're known more for the commercial than from the original album or from
I was gonna say Hot Chocolate's You Sexy Thing has definitely ruined Viagra. Yes.
Yeah, but you're right. I'm gonna be erased, I don't know, in the next 20 years or so. Anyway, so I got to think about this.
No, stick to your guns. I vote stick to your guns.
Stick to your guns.
How, I always wanted to know how accurate or what were your thoughts on Oliver Stone's film, The Doors?
Yeah.
He was in it.
Yeah, no. I was in it for a second there. No, I liked it. Okay, now, It was primarily about a tortured artist, and Oliver, you know, kind of fits that category, brilliant and kind of out there. And I wished it had been a little more about the '60s and the climate of the times, there was a documentary called When You're Strange that Johnny Depp narrated. And really? that has more of that. And I think the two of them together really represent our whole career. But I got to say, Val Kilmer, man, he gave me the creeps. I thought Jim was back.
Yo.
Really?
Yes, he looked just like him. He sounded just like, it was, I mean, I didn't know him like you did, but it gave me the creeps watching him play that role.
These actors are amazing, the way they transform their bodies and everything.
Yeah.
I got a question. Can we talk about like drummers from your era and the African influence, the Ginger Bakers and the and like dudes like that? I feel like I got that bug when I was a kid, but I'm not the same thing. But like, was it the same? Was it my experience? Was it's like everything sort of began there, so it made sense to figure out that shit and how to bring it into your own thing. Like, why did you get into it? And how did you apply it to the Doors or whatever else you're doing?
Well, the African stuff I primarily got into later.
Right.
But I will say that we were recording Hello, I Love You, and we were struggling with the arrangement. And Robbie, the guitar player, said, why don't you turn the beat around like Ginger does in Sunshine of Your Love? You know, and I so I go, okay, hello, I love you. So I copped a couple bars of Ginger,
and here we are, Bossa Nova copping and Ginger copping. Here we are, all day.
I was going to ask the recording of that particular song. Has such a distinctive, like modern, made for FM radio sort of recording technique to it. Were you guys aware of that as far as like, because there's a clear difference sonically between the recording, that particular album and what came before it. So were you guys aware of the sort of transforming of AM radio being the, I guess, the destination point of most music and then slowly morphing into FM radio at the time?
Yeah.
Because there's just such a clarity to it that sounds super modern. Like, even if you listen to it now with the synth work and even the way that your drums are tuned on that song, like a deeper sound.
Yeah, you're right about that.
It could have, like, it's almost like the... You hear the seeds of what Talking Heads, like Devo's second record, even Gary Newman's like first record.
Wow.
You hear the seeds of that in there.
Well, you know, our first single was Break On Through, and it was too sophisticated. You know, it got to number 13 or something. That was due to us calling up the station saying, hey, this is Fred Schwartz. Will you play this? And
Break On Through was not a top 10 hit.
No, but later it became just, you know, everybody just is crazy for it. So,
okay.
Yeah. Light My Fire was 6 minutes. You know, we had that long jam and then we cut it to 3 minutes and then it became a hit. But then FM radio started bragging about playing the long version, which was really cool. So, you know, we had some hits. I guess People Are Strange, I think, was the next hit. And then in the studio, we were struggling, and Paul Rothchild, our producer, pressed us on Hello, I Love You. He said, man, we got to make this a hit. And fuzz tones that just came in on guitar, you know, fuzz boxes. And we just worked on that and worked on it. And frankly, I thought it turned out a little too poppy for me. But that's just for me personally. But I always was just absolutely crazy for Jim's lyrics. Oh my God. Oh.
And what about Bruce Botnick, the engineer? What was his special sauce? He did all your albums?
Yeah, he did all of them. And he worked at Sunset Sound and all the great studios as a teenager with the Supremes and Phil Spector. And he knew what he was doing. And each time, you know, CDs, streaming, whatever it is, he keeps us up to date sonically. You know, he's on it.
Yeah.
And he's the fifth door, you know.
I see.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mother's Day is coming, and mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know, a lot has been made. Most will say that, of course, you know, when you think of historic concerts and events, everyone, of course, makes a big deal of Woodstock. However, I feel like enough has not been made of enough
Monterey
Pop. The Isle of Wight, Isle of Wight festival that you guys did in 1970. Do you have any particular memories of that? You know, because the lineup was to me just as crazy. That year, it was Hendrix, Joni Mitchell, The Who, Moody Blues, Sly and the Family Stone, 10 years after, Chicago. Usually, you know, I know that for a lot of artists, for a lot of fans, this is always a disappointing question because, you know, the festivals are a spectator thing, and usually artists are just getting in, doing the gig, leaving, really not soaking in the atmosphere. Were you able to really soak in the festival at the time, or was it just like you showed up and did your thing and left?
Yeah, I took a hit off of Roger Daltrey's peppermint schnapps bottle, you know?
What was in that bottle?
I didn't know they made peppermint schnapps. I only had peach schnapps.
Oh yeah, peppermint was the first, I think.
The Isle of Wight. We were under a lot of stress because Jim was on trial in Miami for supposedly exposing himself, which he did do. But he was drunk and he got real political and said, "You're letting him shove your faces in the shit of the world. Wake up." And that didn't go over well. So
I don't know how to translate
you don't
to
say.
Exposing yourself. That's crazy how they translated that into that.
Well, wow. I got the climate at the time was this polarized country. And we were, you know, the hippies and we were the Dirty Doors. And so Jim was targeted. There was a rally for decency at the Orange Bowl. 30,000 people showed up. Nixon sent a letter, and Anita Bryant presided, and it was because of us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Well, back to the Isle of Wight. The Isle of Wight, so Jim was kind of subdued in his performance. I was trying to make up for it, playing really strong, but it's pretty good. But the whole festival had the feeling of the end of the era, the end of Woodstock. There was some dispute about the ticket prices, and they busted down the fences and people came in, which, you know, was all right. It was just kind of a chaotic festival. It had an incredible lineup, like you said, but it kind of didn't get the attention because it was sort of the crumbling of the outdoor hippie festivals being the ultimate, you know.
And just for clarification, for nobody, people who don't know the concert and the venue, this is an island right close to London where they exclusively have this big festival. They've been doing this for like the last 40, 50 years, right?
Yeah, correct. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you more of a touring person or a studio person?
Either one. I mean, at first I was frustrated. I didn't understand. It's kind of cool to muffle the drum heads in the studio. You know, I thought you just play live and make a record and, right. And so it was a learning curve, but I like both.
What was your weapon of choice in the early part of your career? What drums were you using?
Oh, my first set was Gretsch, and then I Ludwig. I went crazy for Ludwig and Ludwig silver snare drum, and I always kept a little kit. I had rivets in my cymbal. I saw Oscar Peterson's drummer, Ed Thigpen. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of rivets. And I went, oh, man, that's good. You can hear that on riders. There's kind of a rivet sound in the rides.
Yeah, it rings forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you kept a majority of your drum sets or like the sort of iconic sets that you've used through your career? Yeah, I'll be taking them over. Thank you.
Some, not enough, damn it. Like the floor tom, it's the floor tom that's barking back in the "Hello, I Love You." But it a bow, bum 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 bow.
Yeah,
I like it when the heads are tired and rancid, and then when they break, I have to get a new one, and I hate it because I like the personality of it talking back. You know.
I see. You still have that tom tom?
No.
Oh, okay. That's what I was asking you.
Right. I was about to ask you to send it to you.
Yeah, just exactly.
My address is...
to go in your snare collection. You have a tom collection, too.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Is this a dumb drummer question? Y'all can tell me if it is or not. But my father's a drummer. He always used to say that he prefers playing with brushes. Is that a thing where you have a certain kind of stick that you prefer, like mallet versus just regular stick versus brushes versus whatever else is around these days? Because I haven't been checking the latest drummer
magazine.
That's
not a dumb question.
Okay.
No,
okay.
That's a real good question. Okay.
Don't you play with brushes. That's a true statement.
But he's a snob.
You know what's weird, Laia?
What?
So when I was working on Welcome to Detroit, up in Studio A where Dilla was, he only played with mallets. And at the time I thought, all right, that's dumb. Like, not that's dumb, because by then anything he did, I declared
who's this?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's my Elvin Jones is a producer from Detroit. His name is Jay Dilla.
Oh, so, yeah, sure.
He knows. John knows.
Well, I just can't hear at my age, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, Jay Dilla is a actually, to bring it back to 5-1, the okay, I won't say that. I was going to say.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know you're going. Yeah,
the original producer of that was Jay Dilla. But he would. I'd ask him like, why are you using mallets instead of traditional drumsticks? And he just wanted a different texture than that of what when sticks hit the skins.
Yeah.
So I think at the time I scoffed like, that's whatever. And then I caught myself doing it a lot. So I actually like the texture of it.
I'm curious, what size sticks do you use?
Now we're getting into it.
Yeah.
Here it is. I'm a 7A guy.
Oh, yeah.
However,
my sticks are a little bit unusual because I learned through, well, Steve is like one of my longtime music engineers. So I learned about 20 years ago that the softer, at least for my purposes, the softer that you play, the better the mixing options are, because I use a lot of old ribbon mics. So I used to like power play, like in my mind, you think like, take like Bonzo, like John Bonham from Zeppelin. Yeah. Like, you know, everyone thinks that they have to play like Animal from the Muppets. And that really destroys the sound because the compression in the microphones, like it just crunches.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not good. So I learned the softer you play, the better it is. So when I got my deal with Vic Firth, I told them to make me 7/8 drumsticks, but I made mine 2 inches longer.
Oh.
So that way I could put my wrist on my legs and not move my hands at all.
What? Oh, wow.
Like a traditional 7/8, you'd have to like, you know, most non-drummers look at
move your arms at all, right?
Yeah, not. What did I say?
Your hands.
You said hands, but
sound magic.
Move your arms. Yes, yes. Like most non-drummers would look at what's his name? Foo Fighters, Nirvana.
Dave Grohl.
Yeah, they'll look at Dave Grohl and like Smells Like Teen Spirit and think like that's how I should be drumming, like. Right. Like Modern Animal. And for me, I get the best results when I do the least.
Yeah.
Just beautiful. You know, the quietest. So
yeah.
I made 7/8 drumsticks,
yeah,
2 inches longer so that I don't have to move my arms at all.
Wow.
So
that's what I was saying about playing the right beat in the right spot is as much power as all that animal shit. But you know, what's so beautiful about your playing is the way you sit. You know, you don't slump over the kit and you seem relaxed, you know? It's just beautiful.
A little too relaxed. Sometimes, well, Jimmy complains.
Whatever.
John, you didn't answer that question for yourself, but that's all right.
Yes.
You
know. No, it's 7A. 7A.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Right. They're thin. They're thin sticks, so I can play faster. But they break all the time if you're playing a big concert, you know? But, so, you know, you just throw them in the audience and grab some more, you know?
Oh. But
speaking of throw them in the audience,
you think that's rock and roll, but it's just trash. Yeah.
Speaking of throwing them in the audience, would it dismay you to watch Keith Moon destroy a kit occasionally? Like, is that blasphemous to you?
It was over the top. I understood the anger because, you know, we were pissed off about the establishment and everything that's going on. I get it. He was bizarre. He was the most unusual drummer I've ever seen. I watched him on stage at the Isle of Wight, stood next to him. You know, the way he hits the sticks, he's like he's conducting or something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of brushes, this is what I'm going to accompany myself with on that poem.
On that poem. Listen.
Yeah.
I didn't forget either, John. Wow. I didn't.
Hey.
What I would want to ask you is not which Doors album is your favorite or not which one you think is the best, but which one do you think you're playing the best on?
Oh, that's a good question.
All of them.
That's why you got to start with gun to your head.
No, because, you know, the first door, I'm just trying to make a point. I think like the first Doors album was recorded in just a few days or a couple weeks or something like that. And other albums later down the line probably took longer but you may think that you're playing on Light My Fire is your absolute pinnacle or something like that. I don't know.
A good question. So first album, we're trying to learn how to make records, you know, and we only did a few takes, but second album, we're getting more relaxed in the studio, like using the studio as another door and fooling around with backward tracks and shit and having fun experimenting. But then, you know, we have to make our own Sergeant Pepper. So we get to Soft Parade and put strings.
Soft Parade's probably the record.
Strings and horns and all this shit. And it was fun. And people got angry with us changing our sound. But Touch Me was number one.
Yeah, hey, it was.
Then Morrison Hotel, and then finally L.A. Woman. We get back to the garage and the blues, and L.A. Woman is, I like it a lot. It's just a few takes. I said to Ray, you know, Miles live at Carnegie Hall, there was a terrible trumpet note at the beginning of So What? And the engineer said to Miles, I can fix that. And he said, no, it feels good. See, there it is. That's the key to L.A. Woman. It's the first punk album. We're going to fuck the mistakes. We're going to go for it in a few takes, put as much passion as we can. So,
see, there you go.
It's like a jazz album. I mean, that's how a jazz album is recorded.
Well, you kind of pre-answered. I was going to say that with the Soft Parade, was there a pressure to suddenly deliver like the highest art? I mean, based on the kind of atmosphere that brought upon like Pet Sounds and Sergeant Pepper's, and even with their Satanic Majesty's Request and all that stuff. And, right. Well, I know people laugh at that, but I feel like one day some generation's really going to hold Satan.
No, it's not going to happen.
No, I'm telling you.
Thanks for playing, though.
I believe that there's going to be a look, I'm a guy who love I know critics hated Black and Blues by the Stones, and that's one of my favorite records. So I feel like somebody's going to find the wrong record and make it their record. But what I was asking was, with the Soft Parade, was that the intent to show that we're just as artistic and just as experimental as our contemporaries?
Yeah. No.
Thank you.
John Densmore for the win. That was fantastic.
No, Ray and I had talked about before recording the first album, man, someday if we could ever have some like horn solos, tenor sax, and you know, that'd be cool, some jazz stuff. And so we finally got to that by Soft Parade. Actually, I think Sergeant Pepper and Pet Sounds, they were out kind of around Strange Days, our second album. And that's when we were like, wow, man, this is a challenge, you know, but a turn on too, you know.
The thing about the Doors, though, is like, I never think about them in comparison to other bands, because they have this their own world. You know, they're one of these few bands or artists that can create their own sonic universe, and it's like pointless to compare them to other bands almost.
Well, keep talking. I feel helium rising in my skull.
No, it wasn't a compliment. I'm saying you're weird.
Oh, you guys are amazing.
You know, we try.
Thank you. Hey, yes, we are.
I do have to ask for our listeners and for myself as well, like, how long did it take you guys to come to grips after Morrison's death on whether or not you should continue or not continue and the creative direction?
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, is the idea of a group really kind of an illusion that's not real? Like, is it really everyone gets their equal say, and if one doesn't agree and it's not unanimous, then we don't do it?
Well, that's how we were, but
okay, so you know, absolutely everyone.
A lot of groups have singer-songwriters, Lennon, McCartney, Keith Richards, and Mick, and they're kind of the dominant force. Mm-hmm. Whereas Jim not being able to, you know, how do we write songs? But I got all these words and melodies. We were really more equal because of that, you know.
Y'all were his translators almost.
Yeah, beautiful. That's it. Yeah.
So yeah, the as far as the meeting with you guys and what direction to take his work. Well, yeah, I mean, can you just talk about that period of the decision to continue on?
Oh, yeah, that's good, man. You don't let me off the hook. All right. Good. No, it's good. Okay, so Jim dies, and we're working on stuff, and we first entertained replacing him, mm-hmm. and I said, excuse me, who's going to fill Jim's leather pants? You know, I mean, that's a tall order. Then Ray and Robbie tried to sing. We made two albums because we had this material and we were tight. And after those couple albums, we realized, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. Our focal point is gone. And let's do, you know, we wanted to do individual stuff. And so it naturally kind of fell away. We went our own ways. We came back later and we did a poetry album. Mm-hmm. It was pretty cool. American Prayer, way out there. Jim's words, you know, he had died and we wrote all this music and that was fun.
I wonder if you think that Queen pulled it off, since I was trying to think of another band who actually has done that with their lead singer who's passed. And I'm like,
Adam Lambert.
Yeah.
Pretty close. I don't know.
For nostalgia's sake, I mean, you know, Lambert is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Also, big leather pants to fill.
Yes. Huge.
Different kind of leather.
You know, like my second book was called The Doors Unhinged. It was about my struggle with Ray and Robbie playing. And I love their playing, but they were going out as the Doors.
Right. Like,
wait, you know, Ian Astbury from the Cult is fine, but it's like the Police without Sting. Come on, call it founding members of the Doors or whatever, you know. But
Earth, Wind, and Fire without Maurice.
Well, that's how it is right
now. I know.
Yeah, but
I mean, I understand people want to hear them play, and hear Queen and Earth, Wind, and Fire. I get it. You know, I get it.
Yeah. So now, before I wrap, I do want to know where we are today. Does it irk you a little bit that somehow not only did we wind back at square one, we're kind of way damn near Neanderthal times, that we took 48 steps backwards? Like, just as a person who had ideas in the 60s to, you know, to fight against the corrupt system and push us forward, just to see us come back to the place where we now have to struggle all over again, like it was the 60s. Like, does that dismay you? Like, was your work for naught?
Oh, man.
Love you promised us, bro. Yeah. I said, where's the peace and love you?
See, there it is. Oh my God. Big questions, you know. I mean, this country was founded on racism.
That part.
Say that.
And
say
so, that. You know, I got a piece in Rolling Stone asking Obama to pardon Leonard Peltier, Native American, who's been in jail friggin' 50 years. You know, there was a shootout, an FBI guy died, and nobody knows who did it, but they had to nail somebody and whatever. So in that article, I also said, oh, God, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing if we could apologize to the First Peoples, the genocide, and then we can move on. And that's how you go forward. Admit shit. You know,
they'd be there a long time admitting and apologizing.
That doesn't work.
I know. But I guess I'm an eternal optimist. We got Agent Orange out, or any minute now, right?
Mm, yes.
Oh, we are all counting down.
He's out. According to this recording, he's out.
Yes.
Now we're just waiting to see what Georgia's doing. We're just waiting on Georgia now.
And, you know, between you and me and your zillions of listeners, you know, Biden is a... He's like me. He's another old white guy. But
we wish he'd like you, though. We hope that he's like you.
Well, oh, hey, you know what? Okay. here it is. Mm-hmm. Hillary loses. And I go, God damn it. I'm going to see a woman president before I die. Mm-hmm. And I'm up there. And now I'm like, whoa, wait a minute.
Hey, now.
I might see a black woman
Say
president.
What?
Yeah.
2 for 1.
And I, you know, and she's, I love her, but, you know, I don't want, I can't idealize her
nope.
like Biden either. Yep. You know, she was a prosecutor. Holy sh! Oh my God.
Everything, you know, everything you stand for, John.
She's a beautiful, you know, she threw me in jail, but she's a beautiful woman. So
it was her job.
You know, yeah. I mean, but I still, we're just, it's
we can
slow.
Have an ounce of hope.
It's slow. But yeah. we're going forward. Here it is. Leonard Cohen. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's not here. We're working on it, you know?
Right.
So
always
there it is.
I see.
You can't let it go without
the poem. Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say before you close this out with this poem, I just also want to remind our listeners that the Seekers is your third book, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. The Seekers Meetings with Remarkable Musicians is available. Came out late 2020. And it's you exploring the creative process of modern artist. And
yeah,
we want to thank you for doing this. So could you please bless us with
yes.
this with this poem in closing?
My thing on mute until it's time for my snaps.
Okay, so this goes out to Stacey Abrams, and I'm going to play it. I'm going to play my jazz brushes on my doom back, which is crazy, but so what? And what can I say? All right, this is a poem by Etheridge Knight, African-American poet who I think he won the National Book Award or was nominated. And Gwendolyn Brooks, Pulitzer poet, was his mentor.
Yes.
And so Etheridge wrote this for his daughter when she was 14. Now I'm going to move this mic down in the front of my face so I won't drown out the vocal. We'll see if this works. It's called Circling the Daughter. You came to be in the month of Malcolm, and the rain fell with a fierce gentleness like a martyr's tears on the streets of Manhattan when your light was lit. And the city sang you welcome. Now I sit trembling in your presence. 14 years have brought the moon blood, the roundness, the girl giggles, the grand leaps. We are touched tender in our fears. You break my eyes with your beauty. Oh, baby, I love you.
Okay.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
All the claps.
Listen. All right.
Ladies and gentlemen.
John.
With the brushes.
That is the legend, John Densmore. Orm brushes.
And Doombeck.
Poet hey, vibes. Questlove Supreme.
Exclusive.
Yo, man, I was watching you. I was thinking, yo, they need to get John Densmore and cast you as Joe Biden on SNL.
Yes!
That's funny.
You would be
no,
the,
for real. I think you
could do
kill
things that Jim Carrey can't do, but you could do.
There you go.
You know, if this damn virus gets better, maybe next year my paperback will be out and I'll get to sit in with the Roots again.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove Supreme. We like to thank John Densmore for blessing us with this interview. Very informative. The performance. We got to bring the performance back.
Yes!
So on behalf of Team Supreme, Montigolo, Unpaid Bill, Sugar Steve, and Laia, this is Questlove. We will see you on the next go-round. Thank you.
Hey, this is Sugar Steve. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS. And let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.